Well, if you have a Bible, please keep it open at the passage that Jenny read for us. And the reason I'm going to speak on this subject is that, or one of the reasons is that we have a series coming up in the evening service on world religions. And some of you might think, oh, well, that's nothing to do with me. I'm not interested in that. I don't know anybody that believes any other religions. I'll just stay away. But we do live in a multi-religious world. We live in a world in which other religions are increasingly followed, and they make an impact on political and social affairs around the world. And although we might not see it in this country, religious faith is largely growing and remaining strong around the world. I read an article this week that spoke of the growth of religion, of all kinds of religion in China, not least Christianity. I think the suggestion was that there might be between 1 and 200 million Christians in China. And other parts of the world have strong churches, and it only seems to be Europe and the Western world that are experiencing decline. So it's important that we understand Christianity and the gospel in a multi-religious context, rather than see it as our secular world wants to see it, as a little private affair that can be squeezed into the corner, not for consumption in public. That's one reason why we should look at this. The second is that the Bible was written in a multi-religious context. Indeed, it's hard to understand the Christian gospel unless you take account of not only the Jewish world, but the Egyptian world, the Persian world, and other worlds, worldviews, the Greek and Gentile world of the New Testament as well. And so I want to look at this matter, and I want to look at it through the lens of Paul's address on the Areopagus in Athens. It's a place I've been to once, I'd like to go back to, and imagine Paul speaking to the philosophers there. And it's a passage where he uses something that existed in Athens as a way of communicating the gospel. He found a temple to the unknown God. And he said, "What you worship as unknown, I'm going to declare to you." So let's ask the question, what do religions teach us? What's the meaning of our religious instinct? How can we approach people of different faiths? And how can we perhaps be more interested in learning from this new series? So Acts 17 is the text, but there's a subtext, a little verse or two verses in Ecclesiastes chapter 3. Where the writer says, "I have seen the burden God has laid on the human race. He has made everything beautiful in its time. He has also set eternity in the human heart. Yet no one can fathom what God has done from beginning to end." And I want basically to give you three headings that will help us to explore what the gospel and what Paul here might say, or what this passage might say to us about certain aspects of religion. First of all, religions speak of man's search for God. Secondly, they speak of man's ignorance of God. And thirdly, and this I think is the most interesting part, they also speak of God's search for mankind. So, the first point, man's search for God. In verse 22 of our passage, Paul says, "People of Athens, I see that in every way you are very religious." Now, if someone said that to you or to me, They might be saying it as a compliment. Oh, I couldn't live like that. But you're religious. And they imply that because someone is religious, they're a better person, or they should be. But that's not how Paul saw it. Paul was exploring and investigating what was in the heart of these people. And he saw that there was this religious instinct. It was eternity in the human heart. The late Francis Schaeffer and others too have said this, have said there's a God-shaped gap inside every human being. There's something about us that searches for meaning, that isn't content to have McDonald's and watch films and play sport. We want to find meaning. We want purpose. And people really struggle if they can't have some kind of meaning, because life doesn't mean anything, and that leads to total depression and discouragement. So I'm saying to you that human beings by nature are religious. And you might say to me, well, Malcolm, that's not what I find. Even some church people are choosing humanist funerals or secular weddings. People today are living for the present. They're not interested in something afterwards, pie in the sky when you die. Well, hold on a minute. That's partly true. And I'm sure you've probably heard the phrase of people who say, I'm spiritual but not religious. There's a fascination with yoga, with meditation, with crystals, with fortune telling, with witchcraft, with the new paganism, and all sorts of other religious practices. The recent census in England and Wales, I think in 2021, does show a decline of Christianity from 59% 10 years before to 46%. And in 2021, no religion went up from 25 to 37%. However, the increase in other religions went up 10%. So I think the jury's still out on whether our society has totally rejected religion. And the Bible gives us a very clear anthropology, a very clear understanding of mankind. Now, we may not have idols at every street corner like in Thailand or in India, but people are still religious. Very few are completely materialistic. And many will find some kind of attachment to things that are spiritual, even if they don't want anything to do with church. In fact, some of them would say, I wouldn't go to church if I was looking for spiritual help. They would go anywhere else. And that's a challenge, I think, to us. So, I'm basing what I'm saying on what Paul says, and although Athens was very different from society today, I think in many ways people do have this search for religious explanations or for a moral explanation of the universe. Think of the cancel culture movement. Think of how people are being ruled out of history because they were slave traders or whatever. And there's no place in that kind of approach for any kind of forgiveness. And that's the hard thing about this cancel culture. And it is a kind of religious expression. And I think it's one of many. The second thing we see in this passage is in verse 23 and also in verse 30. It's about man's ignorance of God. All the religion in the world falls short of the glory of God. Verse 23 says, you are ignorant of the very thing you worship. Or another translation, what you worship as something unknown. And in verse 30, in the past, God overlooked such ignorance. Yes, we saw there was eternity in the human heart. But it goes on in Ecclesiastes, yet no one can fathom what God has done. We have this sense of meaning that we were made for something, that we're special, but we can't understand the full picture just by searching. You know, people talk about searching for God as if that was a good thing, as if it gives the impression that God is either lost or he's a bit shy, or he's gone away on a journey. Or as one book put it, and this was, it was I Am Jolly's book, How I Found God and Why He Was Hiding From Me. That's the impression we get if we major on this phrase, the search for God. The problem is that God's not hiding. Rather, mankind has rejected his awareness of God. In Romans chapter 1, Paul says that mankind knows about God. It's plain to him from the creation, from the world around him. But instead of turning to God and seeking him, we suppress the truth by our wickedness. And one of the ways we do that is by taking the idea of God and making him in our image. You see, idolatry is not about the worst things in life. Idolatry actually is taking good things, but making them less than God. And so we talk about God like this, or people think of God like this. I like to think of God like this. I don't like to think of him as an angry father. And perhaps I prefer to think of God as a mother goddess. And we're turning God into a projection of what we think and what we would like. And that's what had happened in Athens. They were very, very religious. In fact, they'd gone all over the place and they'd imported lots of idols, lots of religions, lots of gods into Athens. It was a kind of pick and mix religion. Those of my generation will remember pick and mix in Woolies. Well, that was what religion was like then. And I think religion has become like that today. You pick and choose the bits you like. The kind of God that you feel you can be happy with. And so human religion becomes emphasizing ritual, rules, and hoping you come up to God's requirements. And if we make God very low and very undemanding, then we can be very confident that God won't worry about any of our mistakes. Or if you're a Muslim, you act very strictly sometimes. You fast at Ramadan, you give to the poor, you say your prayers, you go on pilgrimage to Mecca. But if I ask my Muslim friend if he's going to heaven, all he can say is, I hope so. Because he just hopes that his good deeds will outweigh the bad deeds in the balance of fate and judgment. He's trying to earn his salvation. He's trying to create his own way into heaven. And that can be true of the religion of the Bible as well. Think of the Pharisees who outside were like whitewashed sepulchres. Inside, Jesus said they stank. Stinking bodies. Outside, they looked clean and perfect. And that's true of Christianity as well. And that's partly what the Reformation was about and why the reformers like Luther and Calvin had such an emphasis on the grace of God. But we've turned our Protestant tradition into another area of doing enough. I once heard someone talk about a church member who said, well, I believe in justification by faith. As Paul said, just do the best you can. Well, I hope the laughter means that you understand the joke and you realize that's not what justification by faith is. But we have this tendency, and people have the tendency, well, I'm not perfect, but I'm better than him. And God wouldn't mind my little mistakes. The point is that religion has become something in which God should be pleased with us. And if we are very devoted and very religious, then we can deserve God's blessing. And that's not what Paul says here. He turns it upside down. He says it's not God who depends on our service. He has come to provide for us. God doesn't need us to sustain him. He's the source of all our life. He's the one who gives us everything. It's a slot machine religion that people have followed. You put in your prayers, your good works, and you hope to get blessing. And we can see that in many religions. Back to the Reformation again, remember Johann Tetzel, the Dominican friar who sold indulgences, and Martin Luther found fault in this. And Tetzel's phrase was, as soon as the coin in the coffer rings, the soul from purgatory springs. It was earning salvation. But that's no different from modern prosperity churches either. And if you switch on the God channel, you'll find that today. People are promised material blessing if they pledge to support this ministry. And I've even heard someone say that God is bound to give you, if you give him £10, he's bound to give you £100 back. That's turning God into our servant instead of the other way around. Well, Paul, as we saw, was sensitive to the culture and the practices of Athens, but he's pretty direct in his comments about the religion. It won't give them a true knowledge of God. So what's the answer? Well, Paul comes on to deal with that as well. Religion tells us about man's search for God. It tells us about our ignorance of God. But it also tells us something about God's search for man. Look at verses 27 to 29. God did this so that they would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him, though he is not far from any of us. For in him we live and move and have our being, as some of your own poets have said, we are his offspring. I was reading a suggested source of this we are his offspring, in fact, it's in the footnote in the Bible here, probably from Epimenides of Crete. And there's a suggestion that Epimenides was one of the people who brought the knowledge of the unknown God and who encouraged people to set up an altar to the unknown God and worship this God as a way of ending what seemed to be God's curse on Athens when they were being defeated by their enemies. But this unknown God had kind of fallen into forgetfulness. And Paul discovered this. And he quoted this Cretan poet, we are his offspring. He's not the God that we create, but we are created by him. Now, he's not saying that there's salvation outside Christ, but he's saying that Greek poetry itself supports his contention that God has made us all, and that all human societies, not only Israel, can know God as their Father. I wonder if you remember the words of Jesus in John chapter 4 to the Samaritan woman, you Samaritans worship what you do not know. We worship what we know, for salvation is from the Jews. Yet a time is coming and has now come when the true worshippers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth, for they are the kind of worshippers the Father seeks. God is seeking worshippers. Jesus came to seek and save the lost. And Paul is showing that there are elements in traditional beliefs and practices that help us to communicate the gospel. And that's important. I don't know if you recall, quite a number of years ago, a book written by a missionary in New Guinea called Don Richardson. He wrote a book called Peace Child. He was living among this Stone Age tribe in New Guinea. And when he told the Bible story, the story of Jesus, when it came to Judas's betrayal, they all cheered. Why? Because in their culture, deception was highly valued. And so they thought that Judas was the hero. And Don Richardson thought, how on earth can I teach them about Jesus if they've got it upside down? And it was so bad, and they were fighting with their neighbors, with other tribes, the Richardsons, and they had three of their children born there. They had another one living with them. They decided they were going to leave. And they said to the leaders of the tribe, we can't stay any longer because of your fighting. We'll go somewhere where there'll be some peace. And they said, no, you can't go. We want your medical care. Richardson's wife, I think, was a nurse. And you mustn't go. We'll arrange a peace. So they got the two warring tribes together, and they made an agreement, and they sealed it, and they bound it. And the thing that bound it was the leaders of each tribe gave one of their children, one of their sons, to the other tribe to bring up. And that child became a peace child who secured the peace between the two tribes. And so Richardson was able to say, God gave Jesus as our peace child. And when he started unpacking the gospel like that, people understood it. And Richardson went on to write another book called Eternity in Their Hearts, where he discovered elements of beliefs in all kinds of religions around the world that gave, if you like, a landing point, what he called a redemptive analogy, which could help people to understand the gospel in their own culture. That's something that I might say something about in future, but I don't have time to develop that today. Except to say that many years ago when I was at selection school for the ministry, I had just come back from 2 years teaching in Kenya, where the gospel had spread remarkably through the influence of Scottish missionaries. And I went to selection school, and my interviewer said to me, you've just come back from Kenya, Mr. Duff. Don't you think it was wrong for us to send missionaries there and people would have been happier with their own traditional beliefs? I didn't rise to it. I think David Randall could probably guess the kind of person that would have said that, but he was a minister in a very big church in Edinburgh. I said, I think you should ask the African Christians and they wouldn't be very pleased with you. Anyway, they accepted me. So I do believe that God has left signs of revelation in every part of the world, that there is no culture that is unable to grasp something of the message. And we shouldn't be surprised if there are parts of non-Christian religions that seem to point to Jesus. There are Muslim poets who speak of a deeper love than they could ever find in the Quran. There is Pure Land Buddhism in Japan that speaks of grace in a way that is almost biblical. There is Bhakti worship in India that speaks of a love of the divine that could come from the New Testament. So we shouldn't be surprised. Anyway, as I draw to a conclusion, I want to mention another example of other religions. In Acts chapter 14, it's in Lystra, and Paul and Barnabas are there, and they're doing miracles. And the priests of Zeus were so impressed by the miracles that they brought bulls to sacrifice to Paul and Silas because they thought they must have been the gods come to earth. And Paul says, no, we are humans like you. We are bringing you good news, telling you to turn from these worthless things to the living God who made the heavens and the earth and the sea and everything in them. In the past, he let all nations go their own way. Yet he has not left himself without testimony. And the primary testimony he speaks of is the created order. But there are many examples of other testimony. God is seeking us. He seeks people in so many different ways. He has been seeking us since the Garden of Eden. And that reminded me of a song. Again, it's quite an old song by a singer called Don Francisco, called Adam, Where Are You? And it's a telling of the story of creation and the fall. And just before the evening, in the cool of the day, they hear the voice of God as he is walking. And they can't abide his presence, so they try to hide away. But they still they hear the sound as he is calling. In the stifling heat of summer now, the gardener and his wife are in the field. And it seems that thorns and thistles are the only crop his struggles ever yield. He eats his meals in sorrow till he sinks into the dust whence he came. But all down through the ages, he can hear his maker calling out his name, Adam, Adam, where are you? So we're back to God seeking us out. And in conclusion, I want to make 2 points. First of all, this should affect how we plan our mission. If we're going to seek to reach people with different views, we have to understand them. We have to have an element of sympathy, like Paul did. We have to be willing to ask questions and learn. And the second thing is that we need a new self-understanding, because our own Christianity is often seen by outsiders as an element of Western culture. I worked with Muslims in Glasgow for a number of years, and they would usually equate Christians with white Europeans. And someone might say, oh, I saw a few Christians on the street today. They just meant white Europeans. And so when they see the lifestyle of our society, they assume that's a Christian lifestyle. We need to understand things like that. We need to understand the things that put up barriers. And with Muslims, there are many barriers. I'm doing the little talk on Islam at the evening service later on. So if you want to know more about that, come along. But if you want to reach Muslims, you don't serve bacon sandwiches. And you wouldn't normally have men and women sitting together. And you certainly wouldn't have girls dressed in short skirts. These are some of the cultural issues that we need to bear in mind if we're trying to reach people of a different culture. Our way of doing church is not the only way. Well, I want to finish. My time has gone. This is about God seeking people. And it may be that God is seeking you today. It may be that you can identify with some of the things I've said about being spiritual but not religious. It may be that you can agree with some of the points about searching for God, about the desperate need to find meaning. Well, God is searching for you. God is speaking to you. He has spoken in Jesus, his living word. And when we gather for worship, we believe that by the Spirit, Jesus is here speaking to us. He doesn't speak forever. One day, the time will come when he will return and there will be judgment as he promised here. Don't keep putting it off. Adam, says Don Francisco in his song, where are you? Perhaps God is speaking through tragedies in your life. Perhaps he's speaking through problems in your family. Perhaps you desperately want to know this God that others know, but he's unknown. The song finishes like this, and with this I'll close. And though the curse has long been broken, Adam's sons are still the prisoners of their fears, rushing helter-skelter to destruction with their fingers in their ears. While the father's voice is calling with an urgency I've never heard before, won't you come in from the darkness now before it's time to finally close the door? Adam, Adam, where are you? Adam, Adam, I love you. Let's pray.